For our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners, the North Carolina Reading Service now brings you... Indie Week, a weekly issue dated February the 5th of 2026, and it's read to you today by me, John Federson. Here we go. And it wouldn't be February without reading to you some delicious things about winter storms and the problems that they cause. And here we go. North Carolina's snow day problem. The call came at night in early December. Chatham County schools would be closed the next day due to a snow forecast. In Pittsburgh, Jesse Mushaw went into action. Quote, "First, it's the conversation with my spouse. Can you stay with him? No, you can't. You have to go." Mushaw spent the next hour canceling all her clients for the next day. She is a speech therapist who works primarily with autistic children and teens. Because she's paid by the session, she loses about $500 per day when she has to cancel. She also worries about her clients when school and therapy routines are disrupted. She said, "No matter what an amazing caregiver you are, that's going to take a toll on your nervous system. Neurodivergent kids feel those changes. When you were frazzled, they are now frazzled." In the end, 0.1 inch of snow fell, according to National Weather Raleigh office. Chatham County said in a Facebook post that evening that though the county did not fall within the official winter weather advisory area, they were still calling for a two-hour delay the next day due to a, quote, "slight chance of black ice in the morning." A winter storm, you may have heard of it, put school on ice for parts of the state this week, and another is forecast for this weekend. But snow has long been rare in most of North Carolina, leading every dusting a mythic excitement. For school-age kids, these days means snow angels, movies, and hot cocoa. At least, that's the nostalgic snow day memory. With climate change, snowfall has decreased significantly over the past 50 years. According to the North Carolina State Climate Office, Raleigh's average annual snowfall dropped from 8 inches between 1961 and 1990 to 5 inches in the last three decades, a 36% dip. Other locations around our state saw decreases of more than 50%. In Forsyth County, days with wintry precipitation fell by about one-third over that period, based on National Weather Service numbers. The tally of these numbers includes snow and sleet, but not freezing rain, which is difficult to distill from historical data. But the number of school closures due to winter weather was roughly the same over those 60 years. Data shows from Winston-Salem, Forsyth, six other school districts that the Assembly contacted. By the way, the Assembly is a partner journalistic endeavor with Independent. The Assembly contacted did not mention records dating back that far, and neither does the State Department of Public Instruction. Still, teachers and administrators across the state said in interviews they believe their districts have become more likely to delay or cancel school. At the same time, more families have dual-earning parents now. Fewer than half of married couples in the 60s had two working spouses, compared with about 65% in 2010. Taken together, this changes the quintessential snow day. Instead of snow, cold, and rain, instead of movies, remote learning, instead of hot cocoa, parents glued to laptops, still attempting to do their jobs. There are lots of reasons for school systems to be cautious, including large districts where bad weather can have different effects in rural or urban areas, bus driver shortages, and painful memories of bad calls in years past. Matthew Palmer, project director of NC State's University School and Community Aligned Master Planning School Camp, that's an acronym, CAMP, which advises school districts on complex problems, had this to say. finding a solution that works for everyone is a little bit of a rabbit hole. I'll forewarn you, because I've been down this rabbit hole a couple hundred times, there's reasonable to take positions to take in across the spectrum on the topic. Meanwhile, many families struggle when schools close. Jennifer Erauskin, Associate Professor of Public Health Education, UNC Greensboro, said, "Schools are a site for more than just learning. They provide nutrition. They're sometimes a site for mental health counseling, and particularly in the younger grades, after school care is super important." After a string of three weather-related closures in December, Merle Cacibaldo, an instructional assistant at Lions Farm Elementary in Durham, asked a kindergarten whether he enjoyed his time at home. "He gave me a thumbs down," she said. "And I'm like, okay, buddy, what's wrong? You don't get to have any fun." And he's like, "No, I wanted to be at school." "School is one of his safe places," Cacibaldo said, "and it was just so heartbreaking to me." The fact that school closures have held steady even as snowy days decreased comes as no surprise to those with experience making such decisions. Chris Blyce, the assistant superintendent of operations at Chatham County School, said, when he started in education 40 years ago, quote, "The idea that we would send students home or cancel after-school events was kind of a non-existent thing." Several factors have converged to make administrators more likely to close schools due to wintry weather. In 2005, a surprise inch of snow turned to ice on roads in Wake County, causing gridlock that prevented buses and parents from picking up their children. About 3,000 students were trapped at their schools overnight. Blyce said the memory of that is pretty strong in a lot of people's minds. He also says that families have pushed harder for school districts to make closure calls the night before, but it can be hard to predict what the roads will look like that far in advance. On a typical day with snow potential, said Jonathan Blaze, meteorologist at NWS in Raleigh, the temperature is anywhere around 30 to 35, hovering around that critical value. With less precise data and pressure to make early calls, administrators tend to err on the side of caution. Palmer said, referred to his previous job as Senior Director of Operational Services for Durham Public, "The worst days are when it's like you make a call, then it's sunny and 43 degrees. Parents are saying, 'What? Who made this decision?' And you've got to own it." A shortage of transportation workers has further narrowed the margin of error for many school districts. Relatively low pay leaves many bus drivers, as well as teachers, nutrition workers, custodians, and other staff residing outside the area where they work, even if conditions are viable in this school district. Workers may not be able to commute safely. For frustrated parents, the solution to North Carolina's snow woes can appear simple: buy more plows and pre-treat the roads more thoroughly. North Carolina Department of Transportation, DOT, has an annual budget of $60 million for storm prep, snow, and ice. During wintry weather, the department uses 1,250 dump trucks to plow and spread salt and sand, typically starting with primary roads, interstate, four-lane highways, moving to secondary roads then. The department said its budget has grown over time but has remained steady in recent years. DOT spokesman Jordan Campos said, "Between DOT staff and our contracting partners, we feel we have adequate resources to address typical weather events. Still, with shaded rural areas and frequent black ice, which the department noted is dangerous for its vehicles too, the department often can't get back roads cleared quickly enough to avoid school closures." Palmer said, "In planning, we have these things that are called wicked problems. Good people dedicate all their thinking lives to solving them, but never do. I'd say we're in that space right there. Ratha Daniel Ruth's mornings start at 4 a.m. Her first busload of students enters Southwest Elementary at 7:15, but Daniel Ruth has them in the parking lot by 7, saying so that if they need to decompress, they can, just so they can be happy for a few minutes before they go in. Excuse me. There's an interesting turn of phrase. They can be happy before they go in. Daniel Ruth has been driving for the schools for 32 years. She knows all her students by name, driven for many of the same families for more than 10 years. She has seen it all. Ice, snow, flooding, even tornadoes. As of this story's publication, Durham hasn't responded to her request for data on school closures over time, but Daniel Ruth thinks they close much more often than they used to for inclement weather, and she appreciates the prioritization of safety. But she worries about staff who lose money when the buses don't run. Well, in December 2025, Durham schools closed for 3 days of wintry weather. Daniel Ruth and other staff who are paid hourly rather than on salary had the option of completing a series of online modules in exchange for 1 day of pay. For the other 2 days, staff with accrued paid time could use that to receive pay, but newer staff without time were not paid for the days off. Even salaried teachers can be affected. During those same Durham closures, Jesse Schmitz, who teaches English as a second language at Riverside High, said she was instructed not to work remotely, but to take paid 6 days. Excuse me. Paid 6 days. Schmitz, by the way, and Kachibato said principals in the district give teachers differing instructions on days with no school. DPS did not respond to a request for comment. Though not ideal, like most teachers, she had plenty of work she could have done from home. Schmitz had accrued plenty of time off in 7 years of teaching. But she said, talking to some beginning teachers who have almost no sick days, they're freaking out. They're like, I used up 2 of my 3 sick days. What happens if I actually get the flu? In Asheville, Hurricane Helene served as an impetus for public school workers to seek better inclement weather policies. In December of last year, the Asheville City Association of Educators secured the right for all staff to telework on inclement weather days. Hazard pay for essential staff asked to report to work, and an earlier call time for these school closures. Carson Bridges, the association's president and the first grade teacher at Claxton Elementary, quote, we unfortunately know what inclement weather looks like. It actually ended up being the number one priority for everyone, making sure that even if it's a couple days of snow and ice, all of our people are being taken care of. The Durham Association of Educators is also pushing for better inclement weather protections for classified staff. Daniel Ruth said, we didn't tell it to snow. Somebody might have been doing a rain dance somewhere, but it wasn't me. For parents, the snow day problem remains. Carrie Blanchard of Pittsburgh used to run North Carolina's COVID-19 immunization program as the director of the state's Department of Health and Human Services immunization branch. She took a remote job in the pharmaceutical industry to better juggle her responsibilities as the sole parent of 2 young children. Blanchard has a steady salary, but she rarely has enough sick days to cover daycare closures. She said, I feel like I'm letting everybody down. I'm not able to be the best, most present parent because I'm trying to multitask with my kids at home, and I'm not a good team member at work because I'm trying to work and take care of my dependent children. Kendred Mills and his family rent a townhouse in Greensboro less half a mile from their children's elementary school, and the distance is easily walkable, even in wintry conditions, making these school closures frustrating. He and his partner both work in-person hourly jobs, and they take turns calling out to stay home with the kids. Jesse Mewshaw's children, oh, this was a photograph, Jesse Mewshaw's children reading a comic book during a remote learning day. But finances become difficult in seasons with many closures, like January of last year, which between delayed starts, early dismissals, remote learning days, and teacher work days, Guilford County Schools held only 9 full days of school in January. 9. Mills said, "We've gotten backed up on bills more than once." And parenting stress can take a significant toll on children's mental health, said Dr. Rachel Riskind, a social developmental psychologist and professor emerita at Guilford College. Quote, "It's one thing to have a one-off snow day. It's another thing to feel like up is down and left is right, and you never know what to expect in a given week." In an ideal world, employees would grant parents flexible leave. Meteorology would anticipate wintry precipitation down to the second, and North Carolina's road-clearing capabilities would rival New England's. In the meantime, parents and teachers floated a range of solutions. Katia Baudo proposed that, as an instructional assistant, she could staff a neighborhood community center that would give some kids a place to go when the schools can't open. Blanchard wondered aloud whether communities could organize to support each other so that solo parents like her don't have to do everything alone. In the meantime, school closures continue, sometimes for trace amounts of wintry weather, sometimes, like this week, for actual ice storms. Musha said, "These are the real emergencies." She and her family had carefully prepped the generator, flashlights, camping stove, and charging station. They were grateful not to lose power. The first days from home were fun, but by midweek, Mewshaw had to hire a babysitter so she could go back to work. With most roads in this county appearing clear, she said, it really feels excessive to have them out of school yet again. Chatham County Schools remained closed Thursday and announced they would open after a two-hour delay last Friday. On to general political info and articles. A House District Divided was put up on the 28th of January. And it's in partnership with NOTUS, which is a journalistic organization from Notice Perspective, telling in-depth stories about key races in 2026. A House District Divided. North Carolina warning, wrote anti-Muslim agitator at Amy Meck, A-M-Y-M-E-K, tweeting to her 600,000 followers on recent Tuesday night. The Zohran Mamdani of North Carolina, congressional candidate Nida Alam, is actively working against federal immigration enforcement. The Post described efforts by Alam, a young Muslim populist running in North Carolina's solidly blue 4th congressional district, to alert communities to the presence of federal... Excuse me. Dad blamed cell phone technology. Anyway, Alam, this populist running in the 4th district, was interested in that warning from Amy Meck. She attached a selfie-style video that Alam had filmed, though, in November, describing how to report sightings of federal immigration officers. Alam was all too happy with the comparison. The next day, she changed her bio on X to another quote about her from Meck. Beware the next Zohran Mamdani. The 32-year-old Durham County Commissioner is challenging incumbent Representative Valerie Fouché in this year's Democratic primary. The race is a rematch. Fouché, who has served for nearly three decades at just about every level of local government, defeated Alam by 9 points in 2022 and subsequently cruised to victory in the general election. In 2024, Fouché ran unopposed in her primary. Primary elections, including Democratic primary for the 4th Congressional, take place on March the 3rd, and early voting begins soon, February 12th. You look up whether you live in the district. You use the State Board of Elections voter search at vt.ncsbe.gov and check the Your Jurisdiction section. I'm going to read that website again, vt.ncsbe.gov, and check the section Your Jurisdictions. But a lot has changed since their last matchup. Donald Trump is back in the White House with a vision of retribution against liberal hubs like the Triangle. In November, the area was targeted by federal immigration agents, and the district's prominent universities, hospital systems, and scientific research and development companies have suffered millions in federal funding cuts, the most of any district in the nation. In addition, the war in Gaza has also upended the politics of the Middle East within the Democratic Party, pushing Fouché to pledge not to accept campaign donations from the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which was among the groups that funneled more than $3 million in outside spending into her campaign in 2022. And then there is the new mayor of New York City, whose rapid rise has suggested what might be possible for a young, social media savvy, progressive, anti-establishment Muslim candidate. Mamdani's campaign manager, Maya Handa, also managed Alam's 2022 effort, and she acknowledges the parallels, saying, "North Carolina is not New York, and Nida is not Zoran. What they do have in common is outspoken, unbought leadership and a message that deeply resonates with working people in this crisis of democracy and affordability." On policy, Fouché and Alam are both solidly left of most House Democrat, and their voting records likely wouldn't differ dramatically. Both support providing universal health care through Medicare for All, investing in clean energy and infrastructure via the Green New Deal, codifying Roe versus Wade, and raising the federal minimum wage. And yet, they are also radically different in their approach to politics. Alam has an aggressively pro-worker message and a penchant for TikTok trends and selfie-style Instagram videos. Fouché is a measured 69-year-old stateswoman and the highest-profile member of a local political dynasty. Consistently, Alam is a step more anti-establishment. Fouché co-sponsored legislation to ban selling certain heavy munitions to Israel. Alam supports a full arms embargo. Fouché has called for Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem to resign. Alam says ICE should be abolished. Fouché has sworn off money from the Israel PAC, but has recently received donations from PACs affiliated with weapons manufacturers and pharmaceutical companies. Alam has pledged not to take any money from corporate PACs or right-wing special interests, that's in quotes, and has accused Fouché of being funded by big pharma, big tech, and corporate defense contractors who ensure that billions of our tax dollars are being spent to fund genocide and war abroad. This is one of the nation's bluest districts, and in that sense, a bellwether, not for the country as a whole, but for the mood of Democratic Party's core voters. If a candidate like Mamdani is going to ascend to Congress anywhere outside New York City in 2026, this would be one of the likeliest places. But it's far from a sure thing. Fouché told me recently, "Louder is not always better." And the March primary may go a long way towards answering the questions exactly how outspoken and defiantly left-wing do Democrats want their politicians to be in 2026. Alam's first official 26 campaign event took place in Durham Central Park on a warm December afternoon. She wore a gray shirt emblazoned with her first name, and orange face paint peeked from under her hijab. She was joined by 20-year-old activist David Hogg and about 30 volunteers. "Raise your hand," Hogg asked the group. "Have any of you seen Valerie Fouché in public at all? Okay, two of you. Congrats." Fouché's unapologetic about her quieter approach to politics, quote, "I'm not one who's going to be tooting my, hey, look what I did. I'm not doing that. You can criticize me all day and all night. I'm not doing that. My goal is to be successful in achieving the goals of the district, so I have developed a way of doing that that may not get me noticed by the media because you don't see me standing on steps with a microphone or a megaphone." Before entering politics, Fouché was a police department administrator. "In preparation for our December interview, I listened to a 2017 oral history for a local community center in which she described hearing the phrase, 'two black males,' repeated over the radio at her job. I was raising two black males," she said, referring to her sons. "I'm listening to it all night. I would go to bed hearing 'two black males,' or wake up reading 'two black males' or 'young black males.'" When we met at New Hope Market in Chapel Hill, she said she often conducts business here because she's friends with the owner. We began by talking about her first election in 1997, Chapel Hill Carborough School Board race. Fouché frames that campaign and every election since as part of her belief in public service. She describes her political career in earnest terms. "Seeing a need, wanting to give back to a village, a community that had been given to me." She was the first black woman to serve in most of her roles, the district's school board chair, an Orange County commissioner, state house, state senate, and now U.S. House seats. Her pitch to voters, delivered in a Piedmont accent and peppered with quotes from South Carolina Congressman Jim Clyburn and the Bible, is experience. Quote, "People see that their everyday costs of living have increased to a point where it's difficult. There's still more work to be done, and I have the experience and the relationships that exist in Congress now to get it done." Fouché is a careful interviewee who tends to speak in threes. "Nobody else has the experience. Nobody else has developed the relationship. Nobody else knows this district better than me." She's quick to clarify if she feels a question has been framed unsatisfactorily, or to hold up a finger for silence when she's ready to answer. Her allies describe her as a background operator who puts her head down and does the work for the district. Fouché, "There's not a person I can think of who's more progressive than me. I'm just more pragmatic than most." A UCLA analysis says Fouché is more liberal than 84% of House Democrats. In 2024, she secured over $11 million for district projects like affordable housing in Chapel Hill and a sewer infrastructure extension in Granville County. Since 23, she sponsored 23 bills, though in an area of GOP control of Congress, none of those have passed. If Fouché, a more traditional and high-profile politician obligated to split her time between district and D.C., is accessible only through a gauntlet of aides and controlled town halls, Alam is almost unavoidable, especially on social media. Her claim to the progressive mantle is inseparable from her millennial Gen Z-style campaign. Her TikTok videos range from a recent visit to Durham Animal Protection Society. "Simba," she explains as she lifts a cat in the air, to a first-person video she took of immigration enforcement agents detaining several people in November. Do you have a warrant? She loudly asks the masked officers. Like her opponent? Alam said she was pushed into politics by contact with the American justice system. In 2015, three of her friends in Chapel Hill were murdered in a hate crime. After working on several campaigns, including Senator Bernie Sanders' 2016 presidential bid, she joined the state Democratic Party executive board and became the first Muslim woman to win public office in North Carolina in 2020, when she was elected to the Durham County Board of Commissioners and became the state's youngest county commission chair in 2023. She's currently in her second term on the board. Almam, who was born in Canada, moved to the U.S. when she was 6 years old, has pointed to her own experience as evidence that she is the right person to stand up for immigrant communities. She has worked to create an immigrant and refugee service coordinator position in Durham, raised the minimum wage for county employees to $19 an hour, and advanced housing affordability initiatives. Her platform includes making public colleges tuition-free, fully funding Section 8 housing vouchers, ending Citizens United, banning congressional stock trading. Her pitch to voters, in part, is that she is more of a fighter than Fouché. Voting and sponsoring legislation, she told me recently, are, quote, the bare minimum for a member of Congress. Quote, are you whipping votes? Are you rallying your community? Are you pushing the party internally to support Medicare for All? The Green New Deal? But no issue has come up in this race as persistently as Israel, which dominated local politics for a time in 2023 and continues to reverberate. In November of that year, a Jewish-led group of protesters blocked rush hour traffic on the Durham freeway for hours under the banner, North Carolina Jews say ceasefire now, call Representative Fouché. Some of those same protesters also packed and shut down city council meetings. In one tense incident in Durham, a dozen police officers formed a wall between demonstrators and council members. The Carborough and Durham councils eventually passed resolutions that denounced the war. The former urged Fouché to follow suit, and the latter was forwarded to her and then President Joe Biden. Over 2 years, Fouché shifted her language away from her previously full-throated support of Israel and toward concern over the humanitarian crisis unfolding there. She told me, I asked Fouché what it was like to be the target of so much high emotion criticism. I think that's the most important thing is that I listen, she told me, but she clearly didn't want to dwell on it in 2026. Let me put it this way, she said. I don't think people feel that that is a very important issue as it relates to kitchen table conversations. She does, however, see it as an important issue because we all want peace in the Middle East, noting she has always been for a two-state solution. She also thinks she hasn't always been heard clearly on this matter. Quote, I think people discounted much of my sentiment about that situation because it was clouded by the fact that I took money from AI PAC. And she added that in 23, she represented four counties where protests and resolutions were not unfolding. Alam has made the Gaza war a centerpiece of her advocacy as well as her case against Fouché over the past few years. When Fouché traveled to Israel on an AIPAC-sponsored trip to meet with Netanyahu in 24, Alam penned a critical op-ed. Alam describes herself as a pacifist and said she looks at the devastation in Gaza and sees her own two young children. And then, she told me, every time I open my phone, I see a child who's been beheaded. I see a child who's now an orphan. The largest population of child amputees, and it's all our taxpayer dollars that's funding it. Like, I just, morally, I don't understand how that has, like, been allowed to occur. While Durham and its long history of liberal politics are at the heart of the 4th District. Other towns on its fringes like Cary, Apex, Morrisville, Holly Springs, and Fuquay Varina have the potential to be something of a wild card in this matchup because they've been newly drawn into the district. Alam's political career is tied to Durham, while Fouché's is tied to Orange County, and they each won their respective political home in the 2022 primary. Neither of them has previously been on a primary ballot in this terra incognita of Wake County. In 2023, Republican lawmakers drew portions of western Wake and eastern Chatham counties into the district, replacing parts of several more rural counties to the north of Durham, where voters had overwhelmingly favored Fouché in the past. Of the roughly 40,000 votes that Fouché won in 22, about 22% of those came from areas no longer in the district. The changes affected only about 5% of Alam's voters. A professor at Duke, Asher Hildebrand, politics and policy analyst, who used to work under Fouché's congressional predecessor, cautions against making any assumptions about whom these new boundaries may favor. He said, in its iteration then and now, even though it has portions of other counties, Durham as a community, as a population center, is the center of gravity in the district. Alam, however, is hoping that immigrant residents, largely concentrated in a newly added portion of Wake County, will help her. Morrisville, for example, 42% Asian, home to an increasingly politically active Asian American and Pacific Islander population. While the federal crackdown in North Carolina has focused on Spanish-speaking communities, Alam said all immigrant communities are on edge and noted that she plans to, quote, invest very heavily to reach first-time immigrant voters. There's so many Indian, Chinese Americans, and other communities that are struggling because they're being targeted and living in fear. They're walking around with their passports now. Wake County is historically less liberal than Durham and Orange, though the Democratic apparatus there has had recent success in local elections after working for years to try to mobilize votes for younger and more progressive candidates. In the purplest parts of the district, Cary, Apex, Holly Springs, Fuquay, Democrats swept town council seats last fall and ousted Republican mayors. In Pittsboro, the new southwestern corner of this district, nearly a quarter of the town's 4,600 population showed up to an April No Kings rally. Chair of the Wake County Democratic Party, Wesley Knott, has personally endorsed Alam. The organization, by the way, does not typically endorse in partisan primaries. In an interview with one of my colleagues, Knott painted the contest as a referendum on the current state of the Democratic Party, saying, "For me, this is fundamentally not about Valerie Fouché. I think she served honorably and with integrity. And if you think the Democratic Party is on the right track, I think she's a perfectly acceptable option in the primary." For Fouché's allies, though, the election is also a referendum on the representation of black voices in the party. One of North Carolina's other two black congressional representatives, Don Davis, is at risk of losing his seat after redistricting, and NPR recently reported 15 other black U.S. House members are at risk of being drawn out of their district if several Republican-led states succeed in weakening a provision of the Voting Rights Act. State Senator Natalie Murdoch, who represents Chatham and Durham counties and first met Fouché a decade ago while working as a vice president of the North Carolina Democrat Party African American Caucus, put it in stark terms to me over coffee in downtown Durham, quote, "Why at this time in history, where we will likely lose black members of Congress, why should this district, Durham, that's very progressive, say we're going to fire a black woman that is showing up and doing her job?" Murdoch has been an effective campaign surrogate for Fouché in the past, telling my colleague in 22 that she would, quote, brag on her because she won't do it herself. Murdoch is hardly the only political figure rallying behind Fouché, Governor Josh Stein, former Governor Roy Cooper, nearly every state representative and senator in her district, Durham Mayor Leo Williams, and the sheriffs of Chatham, Durham, and Orange counties have all endorsed her. So has the Congressional Black Caucus, the Congressional Progressive Caucus, via chairs Pramila Jayapal, whom Alamlis is a political inspiration, and Maxwell Frost from Florida. Fouché also scored a quiet endorsement from former Representative David Price, who represented that district for over 30 years and did not endorse in 2022. Alam has endorsements from the Justice Democrats, the Sunrise Movement, Working Families Party, and HOG, the irreverent Zoomer and controversial former vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. Quote, what Nita represents here is the opportunity for us to create real change in our party, sent a clear message to establishment Democrats that the days of taking corporate, if you are taking corporate money, your days in power are effing numbered, Hogg told the crowd at that event for Alam. He added, this district was, quote, the best opportunity that we have in our party to flip a seat back from a corporate-controlled, APAC-backed Democrat. After the event, before he set up to film social media content, I asked him what message he had for Fouché. Retire, he said after a long pause. In 2022, outside money was a key factor, said Handa, Alam's former campaign manager. Quote, if Nita's campaign had not been outspent by super PACs, we would have won. Alam has made outside spending a central issue in this race. In the first 9 months of last year, Fouché's campaign raised $200,000, according to the most recent reports available. Unions were among some of the top donors, including machinists, aerospace, and state and county employees, followed by pharmaceuticals. Alam said those donations are in conflict with Fouché's stated values, like support for affordable health care and campaign finance reform. Fouché said she's simply representing the Research Triangle, which is home to corporations that bring jobs to the people in this district, including pharmaceutical companies like Merck, GSK, and Eli Lilly. Alam announced in a press release she had raised $200,000 on the first day of her campaign. Those donations will be viewable in a report due in January, which is gone by. But Alam said they came via more than 3,500 individual donations, averaging $58 each. Her website says she is campaigning without a dime from billionaires or right-wing corporate interests. While national money and attention is likely to flow to this race, it's also sure to involve its fair share of esoteric local politics, like Alam's perceived feud with a black former Durham City Council member, or where the candidates stand on a planned data center in Wake County. Alam recently won the endorsement of one influential local PAC, the People's Alliance, while Fouché clinched the endorsement of another, the Durham Committee on the Affairs of Black People. Parentheses, there's also a low-profile Democrat in the race, Mary Patterson. The winner of the primary is expected to easily defeat perennial Republican candidate Max Ganorkar, whose website calls on residents, be an anti-socialism warrior. Fouché's aversion to self-promotion seems to have left her feeling unfairly portrayed. At an August town hall in Carborough, she thanked a resident who asked her about her stance on Gaza. She said, you just don't know how many times I've been waiting for someone to ask that publicly so I can answer it publicly. As if the local political heavyweight doesn't have the clout to summon a gaggle of reporters with a single email. At the end of our interview, she thanked me sincerely for listening to me and hearing it from my mouth. Her incumbency may give her some name recognition advantage, but it's also put her on the defensive, The challenger can campaign on criticism of the incumbent, while the incumbent needs to defend a congressional record that played out in an era of Republican control. Per conventional political wisdom, Fouché tends to avoid talking about Alam at all. When I mentioned her challenger, she reminded me that she has several. This dynamic has made for a somewhat lopsided debate, allowing Alam to frame the election as a referendum on Fouché, her campaign funding, and her political style. And that contrast between a measured, traditional, establishment-backed politician and a younger, outspoken candidate happy to be compared to Mamdani may in the end be the deciding factor in this race. Months from now, Democrats beyond North Carolina can read the results and see how or whether the mood of their voters has shifted since 2022. In particular, they may discover a judgment on what progressive voters perceive as the job of a congressional representative in the second Trump era. Fouché told me, "It is not, in my opinion, my role to elevate my work." She has served in public office consistently since 1997, but until Alam has not faced a strong challenger in a decade. And I'll say this, if that's a requirement, then I probably won't ever be reelected, because I'm not going to start today doing that. Well, my file has a few more large articles, including about the Orange County Sheriff's race and big ideas from Board of Commissioners and Democratic candidates, big ideas. But there are a couple of small articles, maybe a little more culture-related. I'll get to those and maybe save the political heavyweight stuff for next week. We'll see. "Imagine all the people," writes Storm Rebeck. 45 minutes before the monks arrived, I got dropped off in a nearly empty parking lot a mile and a half south of downtown Salisbury. It was 9:30 on January 17th in the morning, and there was only one other car in the tool rental depot lot. Its driver, Sherman Black, and I inhabit two different worlds. The owner of a transport company, he spent 4 years in the U.S. Army in the early 90s. The closest I've ever gotten to serving was a two-month stint as a busboy. He roots for the Washington Commanders football team. I prefer their arch rival, the Dallas Cowboys, and his 80-pound pit bull mix, Kilo, sports a flashy chain featuring a crown with the word King just below it, whereas my 15-pound Shih Tzu, Butter, is more likely to be found wearing pink doggy pajamas. Despite our differences, Black and I were there for the same reason, to observe the Walk for Peace, that four-month, 2,300-mile trek a group of Buddhist monks and their dog, Aloka, are taking from Fort Worth, Texas, to Washington, D.C. Black is 51 and has lived in Salisbury since 2007, was grateful the monks were stopping in his hometown, but hoped their visit would be more sedate than their previous two stops, footage of which he'd observed online. He said, "Kannapolis was too crazy, and you'd have thought China Grove was in New York City." Salisbury was calmer, but not by much. Cars were starting to pour into the parking lot, and South Main Street was much busier than usual. Black said, "There's not traffic like this on this road, ever." In the weeks following their October 26 departure from the Huangdao Vipassana Bhavana Center, the monks' excursion flew under the radar. Chin Li, a secretary at the center and part of the 10-person organizing team for the Carolinas portion of the trip, said that changed on November 19th when a truck hit one of their support vehicles northeast of Houston. Two monks were injured. One of them, Bantidab Pomasan, had to have his left leg amputated. Online tragedy equals eyeballs. Word of the accident quickly spread, provoking questions. Did the truck driver intentionally ram the vehicle? No. Why were the monks walking to D.C.? To ask Congress to make Vesak, the day that commemorates birth, enlightenment, and death of the Buddha, a federal holiday, and to promote mindfulness, loving-kindness, and peace. And what was up with the dog? A loka was a stray who started following the monks during a similar walk in India in 2022 and now rarely leaves their side. Commentary quickly shifted from confusion to appreciation, helped by a savvy social media team that has posted daily updates about the trip. The monks started blowing up. By the time they got to South Carolina, their Facebook page had more than 1 million followers. It now stands at 2.2 million and counting. The monks are hosting peace gatherings and giving talks outside of the Capitol buildings in all 9 states they're walking through. When I saw reports that nearly 20,000 people had greeted them in Columbia, South Carolina, I decided to avoid Raleigh. With fewer than 40,000 residents, Salisbury seemed ideal. Traveling to see the monks reminded me of when I drove to Ohio in 2024 to be in a solar eclipse path of totality, a rare event that's worth going out of your way to observe. Some people I spoke with in Salisbury compared the Walk for Peace to the Summer Olympics torch relay, which passed through on its way to Atlanta in 1996. Black thought the Walk for Peace resembled a Million Man March, which he'd participated in while stationed in D.C. in 95. But a march carries a military connotation and implies protesting against something. A walk is a more neutral term. I wondered if that might encourage more people to take part. I was also curious to see what sort of people would come. 10 minutes after Black and I started talking, the parking lot was nearly full. As people emerged from their cars, I discovered the answer: a pleasantly wide range. The morning was overcast and cold. Wearing a gray down jacket over a teal hoodie, Angel Black, no relation to Sherman, waited for the monks out of the wind under the overhang of the Tool Rental Depot. A 43-year-old photographer, she was born in Salisbury, moved away after graduating from Catawba College and, after living in 7 other states, returned 5 years ago. The night before, she'd watched the monks walk past the Food Lion on South Main Street in China Grove. She said it was peaceful. They approached and everyone just... She made a calming gesture with her hands. It was really nice. She was so moved, she hugged the woman standing next to her, and together they cried. Buddhist monks have led peace walks for thousands of years, hoping to heal the pain that lingered in Cambodia from the genocide orchestrated by the Khmer Rouge in the 1970s. Maha Gosananda organized one that gained international attention in 1992. Strife in the United States hasn't risen to that level, but for many, it's uncomfortably high right now, Black said. Every time you turn on the TV, it's something negative. When I saw this on social media, it was like a shiny beacon of hope. Black has been using her phone to trace the monks' progress. Their website features a live map of their exact location. An even better indication of their proximity, she told me, is the flashing blue lights of a police escort. As soon as I saw those lights, I took up a position on the side of the road next to Lene Barnhart, a 36-year-old originally from Miami. She had been living in Salisbury for 6 years and had started following that journey when the monk's Facebook page only had 10,000 followers. She said, "I've been so excited for them to get here, because to me this is the next best thing before you go see the Lord. Just to be in their presence means so much. I knew as soon as I see them, I'm going to start crying." Barnard thought the Walk for Peace was a healthy antidote to these mass deportation, immigrations, and customs enforcement is currently carrying out, most recently in Minneapolis. "We need to love each other. We don't need what's going on right now," she said. "My family's from Sweden. We're immigrants. But the color of my skin makes me superior to some people. It's not like that. We're just as immigrant as everybody else." As the monks did pass by in a single-file line, a reverential hush rippled through the crowd. One person held a homemade sign that read, "You are changing lives." Others whispered thank you, bowed their head, or simply stood in silence. The monks' journey has largely been subsidized by donations. Barnhart had brought fruit, peanuts, bottled water, and roses. The few of the monks briefly paused to accept a flower or water. Most continued walking at their usual steady pace. Barnhart didn't mind that they hadn't accepted most of the things she'd offered. She was just too caught up in the moment, and she said, "It feels amazing. It's just so surreal." I followed the monks up Main Street. If they paused to acknowledge the crowds lining the road, it was usually to give a flower to a small child or someone with a significant injury or disability. Every interaction they had was brief, until a 10-minute pit stop at City Hall, where they met with local officials. When they resumed walking, hundreds of people followed them, so many that a sheriff yelled at a man who was walking too close. A phalanx of police, using cars, motorcycles, and bicycles, protected the monks from overzealous observers and oncoming traffic. Forming relationships with law enforcement agencies has been such an important aspect of the Walk for Peace that head monk Bhikkhu Panikkara displays the pins they've given him on his saffron and ochre robe. The only other time the monks paused before their lunch stop was to ring a large bell Abraham Banowitz, head of Death Penalty Action, had brought with him. Banowitz explained the citizens of Delaware who opposed the death penalty had rung the bell outside prisons during executions until the state abolished capital punishment in 2024. The monks ate their final meal of the day, they don't eat after noon, in a pavilion beside the NC Transportation Museum in Spencer, about 4 miles northeast of Salisbury. The crowd that gathered around them was so large, it formed a wall 20 people deep. I only have time to quote some of the talk that Panikkara told in Spencer. He told the crowd, "Meditation begets mindfulness, which in turn brings peace." The 30-minute introduction to meditation talk was chock full of insights and humor. He said at one point, "Probably 1 hour of meditation, you spent 59 minutes following your thoughts. But it's all right. I've been there, done that. Keep practicing, and it will reduce to 58 minutes. The sun started to peek through the clouds, and Panikkara told the audience that a simple way to cultivate inner peace is to write, "Today is going to be my peaceful day," on a piece of paper, and read it throughout the day. In this world, we'll have no peace if in ourselves we have no peace. Peace always begins from within. Well, peace be with you, folks. We will return with Indie Week next week. And this broadcast will turn into a podcast almost magically after Friday. In the meantime, John Feddersen for the North Carolina Reading Service bid you all farewell. Have a lovely week and enjoy yourselves as much as we possibly can. So long for now.